Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. My name is Denny Griffin, and for the next hour, I'll be your host on a special edition of my show, Las Vegas and the Mob. And the reason this is a special edition tonight is we're going to be doing a follow-up. On November 5th, I had Paul Scharf on as my guest. And I'll, for those of you who aren't familiar with who Paul is, in June of 1981, the two people were found shot to death in the apartment at the back of a tavern located in Lake Moore, Illinois. The two victims were the tavern's owner, at the time 37-year-old Ronald Scharf, and his barmaid, Patricia Freeman, who was working her first shift at the bar. And Paul Scharf is Ronald Scharf's son. And for the past 27 years, just over 27 years, the murders of Ron Scharf and Pat Freeman have been cold cases, unsolved homicide cases in McHenry County, Illinois. And over the summer, certain information came to light that may bring resolution and a closure to those cases. And Paul was on with me on November 5th talking about the case, and he's back tonight, and we're going to get an update on exactly where the case stands now, what progress has been made, what needs to be done yet. And joining us tonight is another key player in this scenario, and her name is Holly Hager. And Holly figures into this as she was at one point Paul's babysitter. And her father, Jim, was a close friend of Ronald Scharf. And Holly happens to be the one that came across some information over the summer that that may lead to, or has led to, a renewed investigation by the McHenry County Sheriff's Department, and hopefully will result in closure. So, Paul, welcome back to Las Vegas and the Mob.
Thank you for having me again, Mr. Griffin. I really appreciate it.
And Holly, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And just so people know, if you hear Paul or I refer to Nancy Drew as we're going along, we'll be talking about Holly. That's been, I think, Paul's handle for her now due to her research in this case. So the situation, Paul, now the last time we talked, this information had recently come to light, and The McHenry County Sheriff had been notified, the Sheriff's Department, and so forth. Could you tell us basically what's happened since November 5th?
Okay. I think prior to November 5th, they had officially reopened the case, but I spoke to Lieutenant Zanke this evening. If you recall from the last radio show, this is the lieutenant at the McHenry County Sheriff's Department that Holly and Heidi had spoken to. And the case has definitely been reopened, and they feel very promising that they're going to go ahead and be able to bring closure to this case.
Excellent. I'm sure it's got to be good news for you.
Absolutely. Good news for me, good news for my family, good news for the Freeman family as well.
Did they indicate any sort of time frame what they were looking at when they were going to make a decision or no?
No, not exactly. I think possibly they thought it might be something that they could do quickly, and maybe thinking a little bit longer than what they thought. But they feel like that this is going to be a promising case that they should be able to bring closure to it.
Excellent. And Holly, would you explain for the listeners, please, how you happen to find this information and what you've done since you came across the information?
The information I came across was in the book you wrote, Colada. You want to hear the whole story from the start?
Yes, why don't you bring people
okay.
up so they understand what happened
okay.
here?
Okay. I was traveling with my father, and the subject of Ron and Pat's murder came up, and I asked him who he thought did that did the terrible crime 27 years ago, and he gave me a couple names of who he thought could have done it, because it was never solved, and you know, no one ever really knew. When I was home a few days later, I Googled one of the names that he had given me, Larry Newman, and among other things, his name came up with the name Collada, and I read an excerpt out of the book Collada that, although it didn't name the names of the people that were killed in McHenry County, I knew for sure that was indeed the man who had committed the murders, because it was right in the book what he did, and that's what had happened here, and it was never pinned on anybody, and so it just answered the question of who had done it, and I couldn't believe that 27 years had went by, and the more that we found out about it, the police knew. They knew 27 years ago they had my dad had given them that name, that same name that he gave me for them to question, because he, you know, he possibly could have done it, and that was in fact the guy that was in the book, Larry Newman. So you know, that's we contacted, my sister called McHenry County detectives just to see if the case was in fact still unsolved. She did that in July, and they said yes, it was still an open case, and you know, they never had you know, pinned the murders on anybody. And my sister told them they need to read this book, Collada, because it says in the book who did it, from a whole other source besides my dad, who also gave them the name. And and they were very interested, and said that they would be looking into it and seeing what they could do to get the case closed.
And then from what Paul just told us, it appears they have in fact followed up on what they said they were going to do, and they apparently are making some progress.
Yeah, I wonder what, like Paul had said in a conversation I had with him, I wonder, they don't have any new information. They have the same information they had so long ago, right, you know, within a couple years of the murders. I wonder what the holdup is, but, you know, I don't think any new evidence has surfaced at all. So by all means, they should be moving on it, and, you know, and not be afraid to name who did it and take responsibility for maybe what the police work they didn't do back then.
Paul, you've also done some things here, and you've I believe come to the attention of some of the Chicago media outlets, print and electronic, and also you've garnered some support from the community in trying to get this this case, or these cases I should say, brought to a conclusion. Can you tell us what's happened in the media arena and anything you've done, such as websites and so forth?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, as we said on the last show, that we were going to do an interview with Carol Marine of the Channel 5 News, and Holly and I certainly did that, and the interview was released, I believe, December 18th of 2008, so just recently, and also the very next day, our interview, our story, was on the cover of the Chicago Sun-Times, and that has promoted some other interests from other groups. Yesterday, I did a radio talk show with Simon Barrett, who is a senior editor of BloggerNews.net, and I believe that show went very well, and we're harnessing more interest from those folks. And upcoming here real soon, Inside Edition has reached out to me, and it looks like we're going to be doing an interview with Inside Edition. So we have some people, you know, clamoring that are interested in hearing what it is that we have to say, and giving us a lot of support. And I also just want to take a couple seconds here to give a special thanks to a friend of mine, Ron Beaver, who donated a website for our cause. We have our Facebook site, but now we also have our own domain website, and that is McHenryCounty1981.com. So I want to say thank you very much to Ron. He did a great job with that, and he got it up quickly. Very impressive. So yeah, we're gaining a lot of interest, and people want to see this come to conclusion with a positive ending, because the travel of getting here hasn't been so good.
Yeah, what I'd like to take a second too, if you could, and discuss a little bit about the Freeman family. You know, we've talked in the past, and certainly Patricia Freeman was also a victim in in the situation. And have you had contact with the Freemans?
I've recently gotten very lucky. On efforts of my own, I've been trying to get a hold of Patricia's son and daughter. And I'm not sure if she exactly found me or if I found her, but we've been in contact over this weekend. So I've been talking to Paula Freeman. You know, she's a little overwhelmed right now. She's just picking up a lot of what's been going on. Most of the information that she's received has been coming from, I forgot, the Northwest Herald. The Northwest Herald did our story, and we were on the cover of that. And so she's been getting her information from the newspaper, and obviously I have a little bit more information than that. So we're getting her up to speed, and then she is taking it in. It's a lot to take in.
Okay, Paul, hold on just a second. We got a call from the 847 area code. Let me see what the caller would like to say to us.
Okay.
Hi, caller from 847. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Sue Stavsky calling. I'm Patricia Freeman's sister.
Yes, ma'am.
And I have her daughter, Paula, sitting here next to me.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told that you were having a talk show, and we wanted to just get connected, and we wanted to tell Paul, I think Paul's on there,
yes,
that we want to thank him for getting a lot of this going and getting us filled with some information that we did not know. We really appreciate it.
Are you folks then finding a lot of these things for the first time then, of what happened,
yes,
27 years ago?
Yes. Yes, we are.
Oh, wow.
Yes, we are. And it's overwhelming, but we're taking it in, and I'm sure it's going to help us have some closure, because, you know, we've been told certain stories, and we never really knew.
Mm-hmm.
And when the story came out in the paper, my father-in-law brought it to me, and I read it, and I was astounded, because I didn't know the situation and how exactly they both were killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it made me think again, you know, brought it back up to the surface again. So we were trying to get onto the website, and we couldn't find it, so we were hoping that this phone number was going to bring us to somebody so we could hear what was going on tonight.
Well, I really appreciate your calling in. And, Paul, is there anything you'd like to say?
Hi, Susie. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing pretty good. Susie and I have also talked over this weekend. So, you know, it's been really good to, you know, to chat with some people that have very similar experiences. You know, of course, I've had, you know, my brothers and, you know, my family, but to go ahead and relate to somebody outside of that, it's been really important, and it's been feeling good. So, you know, I'm really glad that we've been able to get in touch with you guys.
Yeah, definitely.
And Holly, do you have anything you'd like to say?
Yeah, you know, I'm so happy that I tried to get a hold of even pictures of Patty, you know, from her ex's side of the family, the Freemans, and I tried to no avail. I tried, and I couldn't find anything, but
yeah.
I just thought, you know, her story, it was so, we wanted to get something from, you know, from her family, and because we just kept coming to dead ends on how to do that. But, and, you know, it seems like the media and the police and everybody, they just didn't honor your sisters in Ron's life in the way they should have, with the amount of attention it didn't get, and the fact that I couldn't even find a photo from back then that was in the paper. You know, it's almost like a tragedy twice. You guys, it just there's been no justice, and I'm
exactly.
I'm so glad that you've seen it and know what happened. It's terrible that you would have to read it out of the paper, you know.
I always
thought, you know, I wish we could get a hold of somebody on, you know, on her side of the family. So I'm really glad
yeah.
that you guys are there.
Yes, me too. I'm glad that
yeah.
it finally came out and something's getting done about it. I mean, it's something that should have happened the first year after their death.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's crazy.
In the one side, I mean, the situation we're talking about certainly is a tragic, sad situation. On the other hand, it's somewhat exciting, I guess, to finally see kind of a movement, you know, to bring this thing. You got two families involved and that have been waiting for 27 years, over 27 years, to find out exactly what happened. So this, from that standpoint, I think it's exciting that this is happening. What I'd like to do for a minute is talk about Larry Newman. Now, Larry Newman is, I'll use the word alleged, because the authorities haven't officially named him as the killer. But Larry Newman had a lengthy criminal record, and he started out his first major run-in with the law was for a triple murder, also involving a tavern, that
wow.
took place in Chicago in 1956. And he, the story, according to the newspapers at the time, was that Larry was in this bar. He claimed he'd been shortchanged a trivial amount. I think it was $2 was the amount. And then when he protested or argued, he was asked to leave the bar. He left, returned with a shotgun, killed the bartender, a waitress, blew him away. And then when he left the bar, there was a newspaper vendor, a young man on the street with newspapers, and he just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and Newman killed him also. He was eventually arrested, tried, and convicted, and was sentenced to 125 years for the three murders. And this is one of the, there's a lot of incredible things about the story. The first one to me is that he was paroled after approximately 16 years after killing three people and got back on the street. And that, to me, that's, you know, an incredible thing, but it happened.
Yeah.
and he was out. And then and these are just the homicides I'm aware of. He did, allegedly, the Ron Scharf, Pat Freeman killings. And he also did a jeweler. He was robbing a jeweler in Chicago by the name of Bob Brown. And he killed that jeweler. And Newman was eventually convicted for that killing in Illinois and sentenced to life in prison without parole, and he died in prison in Illinois in January of 2007, so just 2 years ago. But in my research into Newman, when I was writing, I've written two books about Las Vegas organized crime, and Newman was in both of them. The first book, The Battle for Las Vegas, and I co-authored with Frank Collada the second book. And you know, a lot of times you hear about the mob that they killed out of necessity. If somebody was going to be a witness against them, they would, you know, from a business perspective, they would have to whack the guy. But what I found with Larry Newman was he killed just for the sake of killing. So when I tried to use any logic, thinking, geez, why would he have done this? Nothing made sense, because there was no real reason other than the fact that he liked it, apparently. And Frank Collada, who was a former mobster, and he met Larry when they were both in prison, and they worked together in Las Vegas after we stole together and so forth in Las Vegas. He said Larry Newman was just a very dangerous man. He loved to kill and hurt people. So have you in your research, Holly, or anybody found anything different than that, or is that kind of what you've come up with?
That's accurate.
Yeah, that's absolutely accurate. I would think most people get into that line of work for windfalls of money and that type of thing, and that certainly wasn't the case with Larry Newman. He had a trust fund that he inherited from his father. His father was a successful salesman of some type, I think sporting goods, if I understand that correctly. And he was pulling approximately $30,000 a year back in the 70s, early 70s, from that trust fund, which was a quite a bit of money on a yearly salary. But he did what he did because he loved to kill.
And do you find, obviously this had to have been legal for him to get parole, but do any of you find it odd that somebody with three murders under his belt and would be released in that short a time period? I just find that unnerving to me.
Yeah. Very unnerving.
Doesn't surprise me in the state of Illinois, but yeah, it is certainly unnerving.
And probably... Had he done the 125, I know it was a life sentence, at least, well, definitely Bob Brown, the jeweler, because that was a court conviction. And we think Ron Scharf and Pat Freeman could very well be alive today, or at least
Not
have been done in the manner they were, had he served maybe just even more of a sentence. You know, I mean, everything would have been changed, so... I'm not really sure how that came about, but it's, like I say, it's kind of a puzzling.
It's odd how then he was let out of prison then, when he of course shouldn't have been, and then the fact that they've waited this long to solve this one. So, you know, it's almost like they just keep screwing up. They're not really doing their job too good. You trust that the protectors of the state are doing the right thing, but you know, unfortunately, it's pretty clear that there's big times when they're not.
Yeah, let me just give out our phone number here if anybody has a question or comment for me or for any of the guests. It's 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982. And you're welcome to call in with a question or comment, and we'll direct it to wherever you want to answer it, and we'll address it for you. Okay, Paul, you obviously want the closure and the Freeman family, too. I think that would be a safe assessment. I don't think Susie would disagree with that, want these cases closed out. But are you looking for more than that? I mean, would you like to find out what happened 26 or 7 years ago? Where apparently something got lost along the wayside here that things didn't follow through on.
Yeah, I mean, there's potentially two crimes here. You know, there certainly was the murders of my father and Patricia Freeman. But secondly, looking at some of the behaviors of the investigators who are handling the case, some things definitely come up questionable. The first example, and I cited this in our last show, that there was newspaper articles in the Chicago Tribune about a Frank Collada, a mobster who had some... evidence and made a statement about three murders, two of them being in McHenry County, the other one in reference to the case, the Brown case that you brought up, and the information provided in those news articles are the same information that Jim Hager provided McHenry County back in 1981. And my mother had read the article, somebody had given it to her, and she called Detective George Hendel, who was the chief investigator at the time, who later became sheriff of McHenry County, you know, asked, "Have you solved my husband's murder?" And point blank, he said, "What you read in the paper is not true." Now, I'm not sure what inference of that he was referring to, but everything that I have found in those articles have been absolutely true. There was McHenry County traveled out to San Diego after the FBI had informed them that they have a government witness, former mobster Frank Collada, and they wanted to discuss the two murders that had taken place in McHenry County. And so a DA type and a police type, from what we understand, flew out to San Diego, talked to Frank, and really were not moved by anything that Frank had to say. Frank noticed that they didn't write anything down, and he felt like they didn't believe him or were even paying attention to him. I think that in itself is kind of questionable when you're talking about a person who has been put away for a triple murder. I know that Holly's father was a suspect. I know a few other people that were suspect. And, you know, and Holly's father was, you know, a best friend of my father, but he got on the list. But somehow a triple murder from McHenry didn't get on this list, or at least it didn't appear to be. And then recently, in talking with Paula, when she was about 25, 26, she went to the McHenry County Sheriff's Department and requested a copy of the police report that they had. And she dealt with Sheriff Hendel. He was now the sheriff. And so this had to be in the late 90s. And he provided her a copy with of the report, but also told her that it would be best if she just left this alone.
Now, she left it alone?
If she just left it alone. Now, I don't think we have to interpret that if the sheriff is telling you that it's best that she leaves it alone, then it's probably easy to interpret that they certainly have left it alone. And just that behavior from the sheriff, it's very questionable. And there's some other questionable things by some DA types that showed up in the paper. Dennis Arnoldy alluded to, on the last show that we did, he alluded to a DA type from McHenry County commenting about the credibility of Frank Collada, or saying other negative things about Frank Collada. And what I didn't understand at the time that Dennis had brought this up is how inappropriate it is for a district attorney to be talking about an ongoing investigation. From my current understanding, that's Justice 101. That shouldn't happen. That provides conflicts of interest, and they don't do that. But being a civilian, what I understand from that is that you are lambasting what is going to be your star witness. I've never heard or seen any district attorney, even if they don't like their witness, they're not going to go ahead and lambaste them. They're going to go ahead and use their witness in the best way they possibly can and try to win the case. Well, this person apparently was doing quite the opposite, just highly unusual.
This might be a good time for me to address Frank Collada here. Frank was a career criminal. He met Newman, as I mentioned earlier, in a state prison in Illinois when they were both serving time together. And Frank was associated with the Chicago outfit, but he was not a made man with the outfit, but he worked with them as a criminal. And when Frank, after he was released from prison in 1974, he stayed in Chicago for a while, and he and Newman had then gotten paroled, and he and Newman had some contact with each other. When Tony Spilotro, the infamous Chicago outfit enforcer, was in Las Vegas, he was a boyhood friend of Frank's, and he asked Frank to come out and give him a hand with his Las Vegas operation. He needs somebody to provide muscle and to run a crew of burglars that became known as the Hole in the Wall Gang. At any rate, Frank moved to Vegas set up the hole in the wall gang. And he still kept in touch with Newman in Chicago. And the arrangement they had was that Newman would, if Frank had any hot tips on good scores, good burglaries or robberies in Chicago, if he called Newman, Newman would take care of the job and then give Frank some type of money or commission or whatever for the tip. And that's how this Bob Brown thing, the jeweler that Newman was subsequently sentenced to life for killing, was on a tip that Frank gave Newman that this guy was going to have a large amount of, or always had a large amount of cash available. And Newman went to Brown's place, and in the process of the robbery, for no apparent reason, he killed the guy, stabbed him to death, and bludgeoned him. And when he showed up in Las Vegas to give Frank some money, Frank asked him how things had gone, and he said, well, he said, there was a change in plans. And Frank said, what do you mean? He said, I had to kill him. Frank says, what? He said, yeah, he said, you know, he said, the guy just, he said, I was afraid he might recognize me and tell the outfit, because this jeweler supposedly had some outfit connections. He said, and I just, the longer I was in there, I just felt I had to do the guy. He said he didn't resist or anything. There was no other reason to do it, but he just, so he killed him, and then Newman moved to Vegas shortly after that. And not too long after that is when he got this phone call from his ex-wife and went back to McHenry County to settle the score, supposedly, with Ron Sharp. In 1982, about a year after the Sharp-Freeman murders, Frank had a contract issued on him by the outfit, by Tony Spilotto and the outfit. He was also facing life in prison for several charges pending. And he made a deal with the federal government to become a government witness and enter the Witness Protection Program. And part of that arrangement was he had to disclose voluntarily everything he knew about criminal activity, his own and criminal associates, including Newman, and that if he intentionally withheld important information or lied to investigators, not just in court, but if he lied to the investigators when he gave the information, his deal was void, and he would basically, it would be a death sentence for him because the mob would get him if he didn't have the protection, or he'd be doing the rest of his life behind bars, and of course you can be bumped off in prison also. So that was the situation that Frank was in when he gave, and the reason he mentioned the McHenry County and Newman situation, along with myriad crimes. I mean, that wasn't the only thing he said, but that's how it came about. And with what Frank was facing if he got caught telling a lie or withholding information, he had everything to lose and nothing to gain by making up this story about Newman. I mean, it would have been absolute lunacy for him to do that. And he did that about a year after Jim Hager, who Frank had never met and doesn't know, gave Newman's name also to the police. So there were two, there was shortly after the homicide from Jim Hager, and then approximately a year later from Frank Collada, that Newman's name was thrown out there. And so hopefully people will understand the context of how all this came about. Holly, when you read the book, you thought pretty much right off the bat that this was the true thing? I mean, did you have doubts like, is this Collada guy lying or something? Or
not even the slightest doubt. It was clear as day. I was shocked, but there was no question in my mind. The names weren't in the book, but I knew. Exactly. I knew the story. I'm from that area. You know, I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I know darn well that's what it was. And it was very revealing, you know, to finally have the answer. And then later to learn that the answer, they already had the answer. that I just rediscovered something that was already that was already there in all their information, you know, in their, it should have been in their file anyway already.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't like I came up with anything new. It's just I rediscovered something that was already discovered 27 years ago.
Susie, when you were first contacted about these new developments, were you skeptical, or did you see this as a real scenario, or did you have doubts?
No, I think I knew from the get-go, from the day she died, I knew it was the mob. I didn't know who, but I had my instincts, too, that it was the mob, and from what we were told it was a mob hit. So
told by the police or told by other people?
I was told by the by a detective that came to the house. I had FBI agents that came to the house for a good 3 weeks after my sister was murdered, because I was getting death threats on the phone. So they were here trying to find out what that was coming from and what that was all about. And when I sat having coffee with these guys, I told them, I said, I need to know what's going on, you know, what's happening here. It wasn't just a robbery, because they would have said it was a robbery, and it never came to me as a robbery. It came to me as a hit from the mob.
Now, the threats you were getting, were they unrelated to your sister? Was it a separate thing, or don't you know?
That I don't know. excuse me, I've got a bad chest cold. I never got threats before, and the man on the phone, when he called me, I remember distinctly he just said, your sister's dead, and you're next. And about the sixth time that he called me, I had the FBI guys here, and they were on the other phone, and I finally just told the guy, if you're going to kill me, come and do it. I'm tired of you threatening me. And after I got like that with them, I never got another phone call. So I don't know if it was just some jackpot, you know, trying to get me nervous or whatever. I don't know, but it quit after that.
Sometimes when crimes are reported in the newspapers and on TV and stuff, it brings a lot of wackos out of the woodwork.
Yeah, it does.
That like to get their nose in it.
And
Paul, when Holly and Jim Hager brought this to your attention, you were pretty well convinced right from the start that this was the real deal.
Well, absolutely. You know, I didn't even have to consider Frank at that point. You know, I know Jim. You know, he's watched me growing up, and so. For him to tell me who did it, and then we have Frank Collada, I was easily able to look at Frank Collada as a second source, kind of a validation source. And when their stories match up, and I thought, well, you know, very uncanny about the show we did last time was how Jim was able to go ahead and start the conversation talking about the altercation between my father and Larry Newman's ex-wife, and then how Frank was able to go ahead and pick that conversation up almost at that exact same moment halfway across the country. Mm-hmm. It's uncanny. I mean, you know, the fact that you've got a triple murderer from McHenry, and the man who is murdered knew the man who had the triple murder, and he doesn't get on the list, you know, that's one thing. And then you look at this, and this is a completely another thing. Any one of those two things should have put him on the short list. But for me, he climbed right to the top immediately. I had no problems understanding this.
Now, hopefully, what the detective you spoke with today told you, that they're optimistic of getting this thing settled. And they didn't give you a time frame. Do you have something? I'm sure you'd like to get this over with as soon as possible, but do you have some kind of an internal schedule you'd like to see met, or is it just as long as it takes?
Well, it's been 27 years and counting, so I'm a patient man, I guess.
Yeah.
do you think the police will report to you or give you updates or anything as this thing goes, or no?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm pretty sure I won't be able to publicly say what it is that I know, but I believe so. I believe that they will.
Okay, so you were got a favorable impression after your conversation or during your conversation with the lieutenant or the detective?
Yeah, you know, I'm really feeling confident about getting Larry Newman named as the murderer of my father and Patricia Freeman. But the other issue of what happened 26 years later, there's a lot of slippery slope to it. And that is my concern. I think questions need to be asked about how the investigation was handled. I mean, I really don't know what happened. You know, I just have these things that are kind of alarming, and they need to be questioned. Maybe there are answers for them. I don't know. But taking a look at it, it doesn't give you a good first impression, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And, Holly, now you've been in touch with the police and called and done some follow-ups and stuff. When you dealt with them, and I don't know if it's fair to ask the, you know, the current detective to account for what happened more than likely before he even started or she started with the police force, but was your impression that you were dealing with some people who were serious, or what kind of what did you take away from your conversations?
Yeah, it seemed like they were. They did say that you know, they would like to talk to my dad again, and if I could, you know, get him to go in and talk to them. And when I asked my dad about doing that, he said, you know, I told him what I told him at the time. He said they have it all in their file. He said I don't have nothing new to tell them. They should have it. But they had made the sentiment that they didn't keep as good of they didn't take notes as good back then, or something to that effect. But again, you know, and it just it's so clear. And when you asked me if I had any doubt or if, you know, if I thought for sure, and like Paul just said, not only did my dad and Frank Collada, who don't know each other, you know, point to the same guy as the person, but for the same reason, you know what I mean? Like the whole story with his idiot ex-wife, you know, causing a problem in the bar, and Ron telling my dad, I'm worried about, you know, Larry, because of this, you know, wacko ex-wife of his, and then in the book Collada, where it says he got a call from his ex-wife. I mean, it could not be a coincidence, and it could not be true. You know,
everything matched.
More detail than you even need. You know, it's so the details and everything. So yeah, it's just I don't know what they're waiting on. You know, to make their, you know, finalize, because.
Let me grab a caller here and see from the 815 area code. Hold on. Your caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yes. I was just. I lived in Lakemore, and I was also friends with Ron. And I don't know if anybody was aware to this or not, but a week prior to the murders, I was with Ron, and we were having breakfast, and he was given a warning shot. At that time, we were sitting in the restaurant across the bar from him. After we closed the bar one night, we went across the street and had breakfast. And we were sitting there at the table that was perpendicular to the window. And a bullet passed through the window right between the both of us.
Aye, aye, aye.
Jeez.
So he was, I don't know... I read the article in the paper and everything, but I don't know if somebody that was angry for something that Ron did to his wife would wait a week and give a warning shot to top it off.
And I'm not sure just how long. See, Newman came into town from Vegas for this, came into Lakemore from Vegas. And I don't know how long he was in town before he did this, so I'm not sure he was even there a week ahead of time.
Exactly.
Paul, you know anything about this, Paul? You heard this before?
No, this is the first time I've heard this.
Did Holly, did your dad ever mention anything about this?
You know what? He didn't, but I will definitely ask him because he remembers everything. And that I know he had said Ron was worried, but he didn't mention that. But I'm sure he would recall it if.
It happened. I was sitting there right with him. We closed the bar one night, and the restaurant across the street used to open up for breakfast real early.
The LML?
It's the
little one next to Lakeside?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And we were sitting right in the front window, and we were just getting to eat our breakfast, and Bulla went right through the window. And
did anybody ever notify the police?
You know, I don't remember if the police came to it or not. After that, Ron and I walked out the door. Since glass was on our food, we weren't going to eat it. We walked out the door and looked around. Whoever was there was gone, and we left.
I would say
that was about a week prior to the incident.
Yeah, I would say another thing to note is sometimes bar owner is somewhat of a dangerous occupation. You're dealing with people that are inebriated a lot of times. You never hear of a good church fight breaking out. You know,
no.
You hear about a good bar fight breaking out, and so. It can be a dangerous kind of occupation. People, you know, we've had instances. Now, I haven't heard that one or anything that has been quite dramatic. There's certainly you can get into an altercation rather easy being a bar owner.
Oh, yes. Oh, I agree. 100%.
It's an easy type of occupation to make enemies in it.
Absolutely.
Well, it's very interesting, though. Like I said,
I was sitting there waiting and waiting for this the talk show to come on, and then I was in the middle of doing some work and noticed what time it was. I was surprised I was able to call in now and get through.
Well, we appreciate your calling. Anybody else have a question for the caller?
No. I'm just wondering how close.
Who is this?
Huh? Who is this?
Caller, who is this, sir?
I'll tell you, because
okay.
I know your mother, and I know Holly. My name is Barry Schlieben.
Hey, Barry.
Hey, Holly. Yeah, a week prior to that, Ron and I went. We closed a bar, and it was probably maybe 3:30, 4 o'clock before we went over to the restaurant, and we were just sitting there. Talking, we ordered our food and just about to eat, and shot came right through. Those tables were only maybe 2.5 feet wide, and it went right between the both of us.
Wow.
And I looked at him and looked at me, and I says, anybody for you? And he says, I don't know. And we went outside and took, and we looked around, there was nobody there, and we just kind of head out, went our own way.
See, now, I wonder, and I don't know if you would know or not, if that was before or after the altercation that Ron had with Larry's ex-wife at the bar.
Well, I know it was about a week prior to it.
Mm-hmm. And I think he came
out
a couple
weeks
after.
I don't know what, when.
Yeah, the time frame.
Right.
Yeah.
Just baffles me that something like that can go down and not even the restaurant call the police. I mean, that's kind of weird.
Well, you know how Lakemore used to be. You were still a little young back there. We, you know, people got shot at all the time.
That's what I was wondering. Was Linda
you know
cooking
that
at
the... You know that yourself for a fact. it wasn't the first time I was shot at either, but...
I don't know what you're talking
about. You know,
about.
And people just didn't call the cops for it.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Barry, thanks very much for calling in and sharing that with us. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care, Barry.
No problem. All right. Bye-bye.
Interesting. I don't know. I may have been remiss here. Talking about the incident that we believe led to the killings. I'm not sure we addressed that sufficiently at the start, or I didn't address it sufficiently at the start, that supposedly Larry Newman's ex-wife was apparently came in the bar fairly frequently, was known to Ron Scharf, and he had an altercation with her on one occasion, and he asked her to leave the bar, and she did. She later called Larry in Las Vegas, and Frank Collada happened to be present when Larry got the phone call. And Larry went to, they were in a restaurant, Larry took the phone call, he came back, and Frank said he was absolutely enraged. And he said, that was my ex-wife, and this bar owner threw her out of the bar and grabbed her by the neck and threw her out of the bar. And he said, I got to go back and kill the SOB. And Frank tried to talk him out. He said, well, you know, if it's an ex-wife and blah, 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 you know, it's not worth the murder and so on and so forth. But Larry said, well, it's a sign of disrespect. She wasn't hurt. And yes, she is an ex-wife, but that was a direct sign of disrespect to me to evict my wife from his bar. So that was kind of what brought this on. And Holly was saying earlier how her dad had, and one of the reasons he thought Newman could have been responsible was because of this altercation. And Frank Collada, who didn't know Jim Hager, you know, had the same accounting that that the ex-wife had called Larry in Las Vegas to give him this information. And Frank actually thought he had talked Larry out of doing anything. But obviously it didn't turn out that way. And when Larry returned to Vegas after his trip back to Illinois, he admitted to Frank that he had done the murders. So it seems to be quite a substantial amount of evidence that Larry was, in fact, the killer. And when I was talking about Newman earlier, not only were these six homicides, the four that he's been convicted of and the two we are quite sure he did, but Tony Spilotro, who for quite some time was considered the most dangerous man in Las Vegas, he wasn't afraid of many people, but he was afraid of Larry Newman. He made the comment to Frank one day, he says, whatever you do, Frankie, don't ever unleash that bastard on me. So he and Newman, again, because he wanted to kill people, when they did one murder of a government witness here in Las Vegas in 1979, Newman wanted to go along on the job because he said he wanted to kill the man's wife in addition to killing the witness. And there was no need to kill her. I mean, killing the witness was more of what you think of the typical mob thing. This witness posed a threat to the mobsters, and he had to be dealt with. The wife had no bearing in that. Newman just didn't care for her, and he wanted to go along, and he would have killed both of them. But if he went, the wife was going to die too, just because he didn't care for her. So this was the mentality you were dealing with Larry Newman. And when a guy like Tony Spilotro to be afraid of him, and Frank Collada indicated it was more or less like sitting on a powder keg around him, because Newman was a very volatile individual, and if you set him off, he didn't really care who you were or what your status was in the mob or anything. If he wanted to kill you, he was going to kill you, and it didn't matter who you were. So a very tough thing. But anyway, that's kind of the background of what we believe led to the murders of Ron Scharf. And Pat Freeman apparently had nothing to do with that. She just happened to be there. Is that what everybody understands? She was in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Yeah. Unfortunately.
And am I accurate? I've been reporting that was her first night on the job.
No, that's not true.
How long has she worked there?
Well, I would say she worked there a couple months, but this might have been the first night that she was there. She was taken over for a friend that was actually supposed to work that night that was sick.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. I was just going to say, me and my sister had plans to get together that day that she went into work, and she said she has to work for a friend that she'd come over first thing in the morning. But I didn't even get the phone call yet, and I was calling down to the pub to see if she had spent the night there or if what happened because she was late. And then about an hour later is when I got the information that she was killed.
So, she hadn't been employed there too long, I mean, but it wasn't the first shift. But she was filling in for somebody else, and so certainly it doesn't seem logical that she was the target and Ron was in the wrong place.
Right. Well, we were told right from the get-go, I was told by the police she was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it was a hit on Ron.
Okay. So there's never been any real allegation that somehow it was a fluke or anything as far as Ron, that Ron was the target and Pat was just an extra victim that happened to be there.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
There was a few scenarios out there that, you know, were being sold. So I mean, we kind of had a gambit of things to choose from, what it is that you wanted to believe.
Yeah.
And what people want to believe, they, you know, they give it momentum. And so there was all different kinds of things out there. I wasn't able to gravitate to any of it because it was just too much.
Now we're running out of time very quickly here. What do you have any plans, immediate plans? Probably just going to kind of wait a while and see what you hear from the police.
Of course, you know, I want to be updated. I made it clear that I would like to be updated along the way as they progress. But I, you know, will continue to keep asking the question, why wasn't this taken care of 26 years ago?
Yeah.
So I take it you're not, you understand they have a job to do now and are apparently investigating, but you're not going to let it go another 27 years without some answers, right?
No. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
And Holly, are you going to keep active in this?
You know, I hope that the McHenry County Sheriffs have the connection to get a hold of Patty's family and Paul to let them know, you know, when they're finalized things. They don't need to let me know. You know, it's okay if I read it in the paper, but I don't think the families of the victims should have to read it in the paper by a court reporter, you know.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think they should be told first for once what's going on.
I certainly agree with that. It's a little tacky to have your family read it in the paper and learn about it that way.
Paul has also been contacted today by McHenry County Sheriff, so I believe that they'll be doing that.
Good.
Well, yeah, that's encouraging. It sounds, you know, like a step in the right direction. We'll have to see what happens, but it certainly sounds like progress. So after all this time, though, is Paul, you're somewhat satisfied to where we are today?
Well, I'm, I believe that we're going to get Larry Newman named. I feel confident about that. I'm not counting my chicks just yet, but I do feel confident about that. Although I am very concerned still that, we may not get to ask those questions, the tough questions. What happened?
Mm-hmm.
We were supposed to be protected by you. Why didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So even if they name Newman, you still would like some other answers.
Well, you know, and the community should as well, because this is a community problem. You know, you rely and you trust on, your civil servants, your police.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday I was asked the question, well, what do you do about that, you know, when something's going wrong? And that's really a tough question. I mean, because you're not hiring a plumbing contractor and getting references. These people should be qualified, and they should be protecting you and putting the community's interest first and foremost above the interest of anything else, and that doesn't appear to happen here.
And they should not be intimidated by the mob. They should, you
right.
know, they should be above that, you'd think.
And, you know, and Susie can speak, and I certainly can speak. What happens when these things carry on as long as they do? It's a big problem emotionally, you know, for a person to transition from a victim to a survivor. Part of that is getting closure and knowing that your community care. The best way for your community to show that they care is to resolve the case, and that was eluded, and that escaped both our families. And there's severe consequences for that, very severe consequences. People are still victims of this today. Some people are stuck on June 2nd, 1981. I count myself fortunate as not being one of them, but we have to speak to those that can't speak for themselves, and we need to demand better than what we've certainly gotten.
Folks, I hate to say this, but we've just been cut off. Our time expired. It's the fastest hour I've had all day. anybody who plays this back, though, as a podcast, the full interview will be on there. We just stopped a live stream a few seconds ago. I want to thank all of you for joining me tonight. And, Paul, will you come back when you get some more information, possibly the closure, or let us know what's going on?
Absolutely, Mr. Griffin. It would be my pleasure.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul, Holly, and Susie. Appreciate it. And I'll keep my fingers crossed that this works out and brings a resolution.
Thank
you very much.
Thank
okay,
you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.